wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, my friend.
G'day to you too.
So listen, you are just a reminder to everybody, you are also doing a program with Talking Torah, Jeff Gilbert. Just quickly, bring us the update on that.
Well, first of all, it's no longer in the Hebrew National Radio.
Hebrew Nation Radio.
Yeah, it's been removed due to some issues. I don't even know exactly what the issue is.
He's a controversial man, Jeff Gilbert, I tell you what.
Yeah, again, for me, he's not controversial. I mean, what he says is nothing that different from you know, the way we understand it. But
he's a man of controversy. This is what I'm telling you. He's a man of controversy, but he's back on the radio with you, and he's uploading podcasts on Talking Torah, and the links can be found weekly on your Facebook page. Oh, now look, I don't even look at your Facebook page anymore because I'm so demoralized. I can't bear it. But it's Hebrew in Israel on Facebook, boys and girls, is the Facebook page. And how many more likes do you have? Now I have to go and have a look. Because
last time I checked was 2,104, and I'm kind of scared of that number because it's just growing and growing. The thing is that, you know, in the world I come from, you know, they try to teach you to be humble. And it feels kind of too big.
No, I can't bear it. I can't bear looking at it. No, it is. It's 2,104, and you've left me in the dust. I'm eating your dust, Yoel, because I've only got, 1,900. Someone ticked me over to 1,900. Woohoo!
Yay!
I'm going to catch up to you. Don't you worry about that. But anyway, the links are found on Hebrew in Israel, and there's a Talking Torah page as well on Facebook. You can find that there. All right, so that's the update. Now, we are almost finished 1 Samuel, Yoel. We're going to try and do two chapters today, and that, of course, is chapter 29 and chapter 30. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so it goes like this. And then the Philistines gathered together their armies at Aphek. There you go.
So, by the way, so I don't know if anyone's noticed, but what we're doing is a back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Yesterday, I was looking at the comments on the previous program we did, and there was someone who left a comment that said, "Oh, the spirit lied. Was only 3 days," and it's none of that is correct. Okay, that comment I read it and I went like, I had to respond. I usually don't respond that much to comments, but I had to respond because it was just it was clear that it was coming from a complete misunderstanding of the text. It doesn't say anywhere that side 3 days later. There is no issue with the fact that it's a spirit. Also, the fact that it shows up as Elohim Olim, where the participle. It's very nice to see that there actually are people that can't read the Hebrew, so it does create a challenge. But the fact that it says Elohim Olim, again, the fact that it shows up in the plural shows up that it's not the God, it's some kind of spirit. But what's very interesting is that Saul responds and says, you know, what does he look like in the singular?
What is his form? Okay. Yeah, that's right.
What is his form? So the word Elohim, there's a whole problem with the word Elohim that in one level, on the grammatical level, I mean, not the word, on the morphological level, it looks like a plural.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But in a lot of contexts, it's also in the single. I mean, again, it really, really depends. So she sees something very powerful coming up from the earth,
mm-hmm.
and she represents as plural, and she's also using the verb as in the plural. And by the way, this is a verb not just as a regular participle in biblical Hebrew, where it represents something that happens all the time or anything like that. Here, she's actually using it in a very rare case of present tense. Where she's saying it is rising as I see it, but the fact that it's in plural doesn't really change the fact that it's actually one. Because if you remember grammatically, the word Elohim does show up as a plural,
mm-hmm.
But when it's the God, okay, it's always in the single. Okay? There's mm-hmm. a lot of discussions about the word Elohim. People go back and forth about this. Or a lot of people try to prove, for example, the Trinity because it's in plural. But if you take other Semitic languages that have a very similar word, they use the suffix that makes it look like a plural. So there is a bit of an issue with that word, and I've discussed this on the program as well. But also in classes that I give, this comes up all the time. It's a difficult word because they don't even know exactly what the root is. It's just an unusual word.
Mm-hmm.
But also the issue of, you know, It's obviously, how would God allow Samuel's spirit to come up? Also that, I mean, again, if
that's a good point, because the means by which he comes up is something that he himself has forbidden on numerous occasions in the Torah, and yet he allows it to happen.
He allows it to happen because if God didn't allow sins to happen, then where would be your free choice? By the way, you should know that in the Book of Chronicles, he's criticized. It says that he died for breaking the word of God when it comes to Amalekites and going to the witch.
Okay, oh,
so
truly?
He was criticized for this.
There you
okay,
go.
Okay, so it wasn't just whatever. It was something he wasn't supposed to do. And also look at the language of Samuel. Samuel was very, very angry. Lama ergeztani la'aloteni. Ragaz, the root ragaz is just to awaken in a very, very rude way, with as if he's shaking the earth or something. It's clear that what he did here was not acceptable whatsoever.
Mm.
Okay, so but now, you as a but humans have a free choice. So you have a choice. Do you want to do the right thing or sin? End of story.
Of course. So the controversy here, if I understand it, Yoel, is as we go back into last week's passage, chapter 28, when Saul visits the medium of Endor, she brings up Samuel. Samuel says to Saul in his closing words, "And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." Now, what we're about to read in our passage today, in fact, I do believe it is in chapter 30, is that we know that at least 3 days and nights have passed. There is a reference to that time span. And
This is what I was trying to point out. We're going back and forth with David, we don't know when exactly parallel to when Saul went, when David had.
That's right.
With the 3 days.
That's right.
That's where the mistake is. You think it's 3 days, but it doesn't say that the battle was 3 days later. It says that 3 days later, David found, David went back and everything that he did. It doesn't say anything about Saul. We're
exactly
going back
right.
and forth, back and forth. This is why we have opening statements, like for example, verse 1 here. We're going back now to this, and then we're going to there, and we're going back and forth, back and forth. These are connecting verses because the writer is trying to create a contrast. Look what's happening with David. Look what's happening with Saul. But it doesn't mean that 3 days passed, and that was the mistake. That's why I really took a couple minutes to explain this.
Very good. And as we have mentioned on numerous occasions throughout Light of the Prophets, it's not necessarily chronological order.
Well, the story is, specifically at this point where the writer is using a mechanism to create the contrast between the two characters. This is why it's happening.
Yeah, fair enough. So there it is. So the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped at the mountain, which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish.
I don't know if it's the but is correct. It might be that here it's actually not a contrast. Here it says, and David was at the end there.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, because, in fact, that's possibly more correct, because he's one of the guys, as far as Achish is concerned. He's in the club, right? And so he passes as well. And then the princes of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? And to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me." But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him. So the princes of the Philistines said to him, "Make this fellow return, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed for him. Do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in battle he becomes Satan."
I think you're influenced by that program you did with Jason.
Come on.
No, it says, "Velo yihyeh lanu le-satan." Yeah, the word Satan is an informer. I mean, when you look at I was actually reading an article about this, and they said that the Satan is basically an informer. It was an official position in king's courts that there was a man. His name was, his position was a Satan, or a Shatan, depends which vocalization you go by. It depends on the period as well. And it's the same way, for example, Joe. God asked the Satan here, or Satan. He says to him, "Where are you?" And he says, "Oh, I've been mishut ba'aretz. I've been traveling around the earth." Why? Because the job, this was a person who was an informer. His job was to go around. So here, they're expressing their concern because, first of all, they called them the Hebrews, which means we recognize who these people are. I mean, this is how the Philistines always turn around to the Israelites. They're saying, oh, these are Hebrews. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons they're doing this is the same way that the Greeks and the Romans, or specifically the Romans, used to call anyone that wasn't like them barbarians. So the word Ivri might be related to the Apiro or Afro, depends, again, on the reading. It doesn't necessarily mean that the Hebrews are the Afro mentioned in other texts, but it's a word that expresses people that don't have no leadership. Okay, and we've spoken about this before. So the Israelites kind of like were still in a situation where the leadership was kind of iffy, and this is why they're turning. But this is why they're calling them this, and they're looking at this man. They're saying, "Oh, this guy might be an informer, and can be a danger for us." You know,
they're sharper than the king, right?
They're sharper than the king, exactly. I mean, they're seeing through the charade. But, you know, you have to remember this actually works for David's advantage because it means he gets out of the battle because he doesn't want to be involved in attacking Israelites.
That's right. That's so true. He was between a rock and a hard place, and he had to wait until Jehovah made a way for him to get out of it. And so it goes on to say, they say, "For with what could he reconcile himself to his master if not the heads of these men? Is this not David?"
So by the way, it says in Hebrew, "Halo berashe ha'anashim ha'anashim ha'hem." It actually translates as "by the heads of those people." So this is a style they used to use that instead of describing. We mentioned this when we were talking about Naval and David and Naval, where they avoid saying something directed to themselves because you don't want to say something nasty about yourself. So you say about them, those people over there, but they're really talking about themselves. I mean, how will David prove his loyalty? Because you have to remember, he cut off 200 foreskins, so he's of Philistines. So
the Philistines, yeah.
They know he's capable of killing very easily and being very, very nasty. And they're saying, okay, so how, you know, the same way he cut off the foreskins, you know, he can just take our heads and go back and say, oh, look, a head. By the way, the motif of a head, when we go to chapter 31, yeah, but the thing with the heads as well, I mean, the motif head as well later on is when Saul gets his head chopped off. It's a very symbolic thing. There's actually a document about one of the Persian kings or something that he feasted with his wife in a garden after a battle, and they hung the head of the king of the enemy they had. And they were just, this was just like a trophy. Oh, look, it's someone's head. It's like when people collect trophies. No, seriously, it almost sounds like as if they're collecting trophies like people collect when they go hunting. It's like, I got this
big he did that with Goliath, right? He wandered around Jerusalem with the trophy that was Goliath's
exactly.
head.
Exactly. So, again, this is very interesting that they were living in the culture they were in. I mean, I always have this discussion with people back and forth all the time about, you know, what is real Israelite culture and everything. And there is nothing specific because cultures change all the time. You know, it's like, I have one of my friends, on Facebook, you know, he asked me about, certain issues of, you know, how come there are Hittite, documentation that's similar to the book of Deuteronomy. Now he knows exactly who that's him. You know, and they immediately say, oh, the Israelites were copying and everything. This is really, everyone was together. This was one big mishmash of stuff. And when, for example, when the book of Deuteronomy was written, it was written in a very, very specific style. And there's an interesting book called Treaty of the Great King. And he kind of goes bit by bit proving, that it fits this treaty. Now, I did read lately that there's an opinion that says that these treaties are a latter. They're not as early as they thought they were, but it's a dispute. Some people say they're earlier, some people say they're later. But the fact remains that the style was recognized. Okay, so it means they lived in their culture. I mean, really, I mean, one of the things that I learned throughout the years is to recognize, you know, there's an issue of how do you read things, how you recognize stuff. And really, you know, for example, if I write a cookbook, you know, I worked as a cook. And if you don't use terminology in the cooking world, then some stuff. And if I tell them, oh, you need to cut the carrot as if it's like tiny little matches. Instead of saying that, you write, cut them as julienne. You know, okay, now I know what you mean. So this is at least the way I understand it, that there's a specific code and a specific style of writing that was recognizable. We're relearning this stuff now because a lot of it was lost, but because of the Greeks and because of people's misunderstanding of how the Bible and how the text was written. But we're relearning this stuff and we're discovering a lot of new things. I mean, it's, a lot of this stuff is well known. And, you know, for me, you know, some of it is new, some of it's old. But there's even a statement from the rabbis that say something very, very important. And they say, you know, the Torah spoke in the language of men. You know, it's, mm-hmm. I think that's a very, very clear statement that really, really proves what I have to say about this. And I think they were 100% correct on this one. Anyhow, we're going off track from the storyline.
Coming back, was they go on to say, is this not David of whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? So they knew this song.
Yeah, it was a well-known thing.
Yeah, it was a well-known thing.
Yeah, didn't they say that as well when he went for the first time to Achish?
I think you might be right. 18 verse 7.
Yeah, 18, so, eight, no, it's in chapter 21. Verse 12. And the servants of the Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Or is it not that is this the one that they sang to him in dancing, saying, Saul has struck him by the thousands and David by the tens of thousands? It's the same thing. So this is the nickname of David, the song. This is the song that follows him around for a while.
His reputation precedes him. Then Achish called David and said to him, surely as Yehovah lives. So Achish said, he speaks the name. He says, surely as Yehovah lives, you have been upright, and you're going out and you're coming in with me in the army is good in my sight. For to this day I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not favor you. Therefore now return, go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. So there you go.
I don't think it's surprising that he mentions, you know, he says the oath form the way an Israelite would, because he's trying to affirm the fact that he's taking the truth. Because he knows David doesn't worship his gods. You know, so he's going, okay, I have to say something that will make it clear that I'm telling the truth. So he takes an oath in the name of God, the God of Israel. I think there's nothing unusual about that.
Fair enough. So David said to Achish, now David protests. This is so funny because...
Well, he has to make it look real.
You know? He's got to make it look real. So he says, but what have I done? And to this day, what have you found in your servant as long as I've been with you that I may not go and fight against the enemies of the Lord, the king? And Achish answered and said to David...
Well, it's not the Lord, it's my Lord, the king.
My Lord, the king.
Adoni HaMelech, my Lord, the king.
Then Achish answered and said to David, I know that you are good in my sight as an angel of God, as a messenger of God.
The angel of God. I mean, if you say, the problem when you say angel, it gives a certain connotation. But I think here he's really trying to say angel of God, that he's a perfect messenger.
Sure. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us into battle. Therefore, now rise early in the morning with your master's servants who have come with you. And as soon as you are up early in the morning.
It doesn't say blah, blah, blah in the text.
It doesn't say blah, blah, blah. It says, and as soon as you are up early in the morning and have light, depart. So David and his men rose to depart in the morning and to return to the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. And that was it. And
so the question arises, why is he telling to leave first? Why is he saying, I'll leave early in the morning? So it was common practice, at least from what I know, it was a common practice that if you had to leave an army camp, you did it early in the morning. So first of all, you get an early start and you don't leave where you're going to be traveling at night. But there's also another side of it. It was an embarrassment to leave a battlefield. It was an embarrassment to leave a camp that's about to go out to war.
So get up early and disappear before everyone else to save face.
Yeah, disappear before anyone sees you. So it's not as embarrassing. And I think the Talmud mentions this as well. I mean, there's a wealth of knowledge there in the Talmud that's really important. I might disagree with some interpretations, but there's also a lot of interesting pieces of information there.
Sure.
And I think they mentioned this as well that by the Israelite law, and this was probably the common practice in the ancient world in general, that they the people had to leave the battlefield due to, you know, if they're married and they haven't, if they got engaged and haven't married, if they've built a house and they haven't finished the house, if they have a vineyard. Again, I'm not saying it's an older or someone who's just afraid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't have someone who's just scared out of their mind because it demoralized the unit. So these people, they say, if I remember correctly, they say that they leave very early in the morning so no one sees them.
Fair enough. And so that's, now we find ourselves, Yoel, in 1 Samuel chapter 30, and it says, now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, there it is, there's our third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire and had taken captive the women and those who were there, from great to from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So David and his men came to the city.
It's very interesting that the Amalekites, no matter what you do to them, you kill them, you whatever, they always keep on showing up.
Yeah.
They keep on popping up everywhere all the time, no matter what you do. They're there.
Yeah.
And they're in a pain in everyone's neck. Mm. But the question I sometimes ask myself is, are these really the Amalekites? Are these kind of like groups that were referenced to as Amalekites at one point, and these are not the original Amalekites? I mean, it seems that the Amalekites are kind of like raiders.
Well, it seems to me, that Shaul, he did, though he didn't do what he was supposed to do, he did deal them a mighty blow, and I would have, it sounded to me like he had, cut them down to size, and yet there's still some of them, as you say, around the countryside raiding.
Exactly, so it could be that they might have been reduced to like warlords or something, so they have... They hire people. They just say, if you go around with us, you go to battles with us, and you get the loot and everything. So it might be that these are not, these might not be the Amalekites as a full entity. This might be just, remnants of the Amalekites, but they keep on showing up. The other thing that might be going on here is that the Amalekites are recognized as the biggest thorn in our side throughout whole centuries. I mean, to a point where, every time that we talk, for example, when religious Jews mention the Amalekites, when they mention the Nazis, they'll say they're like Amalekites and stuff like that. So it could be that the word Amalekite really just became a term for enemies of Israel, and that's it.
The Amalekites are the quintessential enemies of Israel, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So David and his men, they came to Ziklag and to the city, and it was burnt with fire. Their wives and their sons and their daughters have been taken captive, and David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Now, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, Yoel, because of the soul of the people was grieved, but every man for his son and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in Yehovah his God. So there was murmuring of stoning him for what had happened.
Yeah. So, and first, it's very interesting how it's worded, but it kind of reminds me a bit of Moses. Moses, every time something went wrong, they just started blaming him. I mean, it's very easy to go point your fingers at, it's the leader's fault. No, it's not always necessarily the leader's fault. Sometimes there's something else going on that, I mean, how can you blame him? His hand was forced into a certain place. He had to be with the Philistines for a while. This is why he went into Ziklag, to protect them. Mm. But it's always easy to blame someone else, where sometimes you just have to be aware of the fact that stuff happens.
Things
happen, and there's nothing you can do about it. This stuff
happens. Not only that, Yoel, but stuff happens to King David, and stuff happens to him and his loyal men. And when you read this in these verses that we just read, you can be forgiven for thinking, well, why did Yehovah allow that to happen? Is not King David the anointed? Will he not be king of Israel? Why would God allow Ziklag to be?
There might be a reason not mentioned here, that it's important that he won't be in Ziklag, that he'd be preoccupied fighting an enemy, so the Philistines wouldn't have an excuse to attack him.
Mm-hmm. So there's,
say, where were you when, because he knew the battle formations, he might have been in the plans. So now they sent him home, and they'll say, well, maybe he's going to send messengers to the Israelites telling us our battle plans. And he's going to be busy doing, he has proof that he was busy with something else.
He's got an alibi, right?
And also, it's an alibi, but I think it's also something to distract him from wanting to go and help the Israelites, because he might get word that the battle is going sour at some stage, and he has to be busy doing something else.
And as we will find out, there's other benefits to this as well. But he is strengthened. He strengthened himself in Yehovah, his God. Then David said to Abiathar, the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired of Yehovah, saying, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and he came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind.
And there were some that were left behind. Your translation's not good. Vanotrim amadu. So it says vanotrim amadu.
Oh, and it goes on to
it mentions that he went all the way there, and then there was a whole left notal. The word notal is a leftover, but it's the wording is a bit strange.
It's a little bit clumsy to read, but it goes on to say.
Let me see if there's another version, and maybe
see what you got there. But I'll read verse 10. But David pursued, and he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. So they found an Egyptian, Yoel, in the field and brought him to David, and they gave him bread and he ate, and they let him drink water, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs, two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights, Yoel.
Yeah, so first of all, average translation says, then as David and 400 men continued to pursue, 200 men who were too exhausted to cross the Wadi Besor stayed behind. I think the person who translated this was trying to redo the text to make it more readable. It's not really accurate.
It says here
the extensive confusion exhibited in the Septuagint in verses 9 and 10 must have developed partly out of uncertainty about the size of David's force. Basically saying that the wording, everyone's very confused about the wording here, because it says, the Hebrew kind of like says, oh, there's people that were left behind, but it doesn't really tell you there were people left behind. It says, and the left behinds stood. And It's not really specific enough to tell us exactly what's going on. We only figure out what's going on when we read the next verse. So it is a little clumsy here. And then verse 10 kind of clarifies verse 9. And then they find an Egyptian man, which indicates
they found an Egyptian slave. Now this is what I want to know, because it says
it doesn't say slave. It says a man.
It says a man.
But he does mention later on in verse 13 that he's a slave or a master. Master. But what's also very very interesting here is the fact that they have an Egyptian amongst them, which might indicate what I said earlier that this is not a pure Amalekite army. This is actually a group led by Amalekites, but they're really just mercenaries.
So what you're saying is it's possible that he's an Egyptian mercenary, and that he's hired by perhaps some princes of Amalek, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also very interesting they give him a pelach dvela, piece of a fig cake, and two raisins. Now, these must have been pretty big raisins. I mean, you know, that's not enough to wake someone up. But what they're doing here is they're trying to replenish the sugars in his body and everything. Yeah. And this was also noticed that this is some of the same stuff that Avigail brought over. When David was looking for food.
Yeah.
Which means this was a very common food, and even today when you come to Israel, you know, raisins and figs and dates and everything, all that stuff. I mean, you were in Israel, you've had the majhul, the fresh majhul, the good ones. No, not fresh, but the high quality juicy ones. What it does to you? You know, you eat it and your body goes like, oh well, that's a good thing. So this was the common stuff that people would put out when you put out for someone a piece of cake today, they didn't eat really. I mean, they probably did eat some types of cakes. I mean, it does mention, I did write about in Facebook about the word fanag, and fanag is a type of flour, or actually a type of, this is from Ezekiel 27, it's a type of flour or a type of cake. I did mention that the Egyptians, at one stage I mentioned the Egyptians had, dozens of types of cakes. I think there was like 30 odd types of bread, and dozens of types of cakes. And, so this is something that was well known, but On the other hand, when you're trying to just revive someone, you don't give him something made out of flour because it's too heavy. You want to get the sugars in very quickly. Mm. So this was probably a very common refresh yourself type of food.
And he was revived because now this is what I want to know, Yoel, because he hadn't eaten bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. Now that means two nights and one day, right?
No, it might have been 3 days and three nights, and they found him on the fourth day.
What it means is it means 2 days and two nights, right?
No, it says 3 days and three nights. I think the text is very clear.
You think so? Okay, so it's 3 days and three nights.
It says, "Ki lo achal lechem velo shata mayim shlosha yamim veshlosha leilot." It's talking about 72 hours straight.
I don't know what I was thinking. Verse 13. Then David said to him, "To whom do you belong?"
What's going on? You can't read properly. You're missing out. What's going on with you? So what if we started recording earlier?
Nothing. Just checking. Just wanted to be sure. Then David said to him, "To whom do you belong? Where are you from?" And he said, "I'm a young man from Egypt, servant of Amalekite. And my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick." Yeah, nice. And
it kind of tells you how nasty the Amalekites are. I mean, he's sick. Okay, just dump him.
Yeah. "We made an invasion of the southern area of the Heratites." Is that what he got?
Hakereti. So some people say maybe this is part of the people of Keret.
It's in the territory?
But it's not very clear if this is Keret, because Keret was in the north. This might be some other place. Also notice the way he asks him is he's questioning him, you know, "Who are you? Where are you from?" You know, he's interrogating like an officer should.
And you would be too, because the lives of your wives and sons and daughters rely on it, and so we hope that this guy has something to say. And sure enough, he does, and he says, he's in the territory which belongs to Judah in the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And it's like, okay, so we're onto him. This is the guy.
Okay, this is who we're looking for, yeah.
This is who we're looking for. "Can you take us down to this troop?" So he said, "Swear to me by your God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this troop." So obviously they agree. And when he had brought him down, there they were, spread out all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. Then David, so obviously, Yoel, that...
Oh, wait, we went ahead and missed a note here. So he says to him, "Take an oath by God, if you kill me or give me away to my master." So there was a law in the ancient world. And this is, you find this in the Code of Hammurabi as well. It's one of the first codes. It's like in the 20s or the 30s of the codes, where it says that if a person finds a servant or actually finds a slave and does not give him back to his master, that person actually, I think, is even liable for execution, because the Code of Hammurabi is strongly oriented around the issue of, you know, possession. It doesn't really care much about life. It cares about possession. So, for example, if you find a possession of someone and you don't give it back, you're as if you're stealing, and stealing is a capital punishment. So here, you know, this isn't an Egyptian. He knows the Near Eastern law, and he says, "Okay, don't give me back to my master." David, on the other hand, has his law in the Torah that says, don't give back a servant to his master. Okay? It's a law in Deuteronomy 23, I think, 23. What is it? 16:17, I think it is.
That if he escapes, It's up to his master to retrieve him. But if you find him, you don't bring him back.
You don't bring him back. I think it's even more than that. You give him shelter wherever he wishes to go to. So, and again, a servant escaping, this is probably the situation that Torah is talking about. We're not talking just some servant, you know, some slave who's an Israelite slave, because the Israelite laws have something else. The Torah might be specifically, and again, only speculating, but the Torah might be specifically talking about slaves who run away from their masters from foreign countries.
Yeah,
because maybe that's what it's talking about. So this is a pure case of a practice of keeping the Torah inside the text, or a hint to keeping the Torah.
Fair enough. And so, and it certainly seems that they've been raiding. It wasn't just Ziklag. They've been, you know, raiding roundabouts, and they've got a whole lot of stuff, and they're pretty happy about it. So here they are,
and they're not prepared for anything. They're not prepared for anything. Yeah. We're done with everyone in this area. There's nothing to worry about. So this is as if God's giving these Amalekites over in a silver platter.
Yeah, that's right. And so then David attacked them from twilight until evening the next night. Not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away. And David's very clear about this. David rescued his two wives, and nothing of theirs was lacking, neither small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all.
Then, so I think there's a hint here to the, there's no real danger. It was all planned. Everything is in control. Mm-hmm. God just had to keep him occupied because something else was happening that he didn't want him involved in.
But not only that, but the next verse, Yoel, it says, David took all the flocks and herds that they had driven before those other... Then David took all the flocks and herds they had driven before those other livestock and said, this is David's spoil. So not only does he get everything back, but he gets all the other stuff as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so now he cleans up. So now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they had also made to stay at the brook Besor. And so they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. But, then all the wicked and worthless men...
So again, we're seeing a lot of culture coming out in this chapter. So mm-hmm. It's customary that when your leader... When your leader, master in chief shows back up, you have to greet him, and mm-hmm. he greets them back. This is how the custom was. So, for example, in the Jewish world, even to this very day, when an important character shows up, you always go out to greet them. You don't say, oh, they're here, I'll big whoop. There's always an issue of greeting. It's always like that when an important rabbi goes to a community, they always have a greeting. He shows up in the car and people are there waiting for him to say hello. Right. Today in the Western world, they do that, but it's more for ceremonies with governments and stuff like that. When an important character shows up, then you go out to greet them. Or if it's an official meeting, it's an official visit, then there's a whole, you greet the person when they come off the plane. It's the same idea. Okay.
Sure.
It's just with us, it's done all the time.
Oh, good point. Good point. But then there were wicked and worthless men, and we've spoken about that before, men of Belial, of those who went with David and answered and said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. But David said...
I have a question. Can you read the first couple of words from verse 22 again? The first couple of words.
Then all the wicked and worthless men.
Okay, so in the Hebrew it's all wicked man. Okay.
Wicked
it says
man?
Here, Vayan kol ish ra uvlial, meha anashim asher alchu im David. Every wicked man from who's ra and blial, who's wicked and blial, from the men who went with him. So why does it say ish? Why does it use the singular? So there's an interesting hint here, maybe, that they spoke to each person as an individual said to himself, what is this? And then when they suddenly realized that there were more of them, kind of upset with the fact that these 200 people did absolutely nothing. Why did they get? They joined together to complain. But it started off as every single person to himself, and then they recognized each other that there's a mutual complaint here.
Right. Okay, I'm with you. Okay,
you have to kind of like, this is what you gain from reading it from the Hebrew. You don't get all these mistranslations. But this is not a mistranslation where it changes the meaning of a text. It's just, you have to remember, this is a narrative. There are mechanisms of how these things are written. There's a hints here and there. I mean, the Book of Samuel is one of the classics where you learn narrative because it's one of the longest narratives that exist. Book of Judges is taught as a very important book in the issue of editing. The Book of Samuel has a lot of very, very important storylines. There's a lot of these little mechanisms that show up here and there.
Good point. And but David said, my brethren, you shall not do so with what Jehovah has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hands the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays with the supplies. They shall share alike. And this is interesting to me, Yoel, verse 25. So it was, from that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day.
So this is a side note. We have a couple of these in the text. It shows up in different places. For example, in Genesis, it says, "Now, therefore, the children of Israel will not eat the
part of the leg,
the part of the
Jacob bristling with the
Gidon Asher Asher al Akaf, probably sciatic nerve. I mean, I did have a discussion some time back with Nehemia. He claimed it had to do with the penis of the animal. Mm. I really seriously doubt that, because it has to be something that's mutual in all animals, and female cows, for example, don't have a penis. So, and it's also not on the cuff. The cuff is the thigh itself. It's actually the cuff is the outer, actually it's the outer thigh. So it's, I think it's easier to say it's the sciatic nerve, because the cuff is really the rounded part, not mm-hmm. the interior, but it might be, if you look at the shape of the bone, it might be the interior, but it doesn't really matter. The issue is that it's actually inside the thigh itself. It's not hanging from the belly like it does with oxes and goats and basically most four-legged animals. So that's one example. And there are a few places where you have these side notes where it mentions, therefore, this and this is done. You know, for example, that later on we have the story of Amnon and Tamar, where it says that the custom of the virgins of Israel was they wore striped clothing or something. You know, so it was you have these side notes every once in a while that tell us these things. So here we have a rule, a kind of like a commandment or something like that, a practice that's not Torah, but was practiced amongst the Israelites from that day that they fall. I mean, it shows that there's nothing wrong with customs. There's nothing wrong with laws which are created by kings or by people or decisions that people take upon themselves, as long as they don't make that take it to replace Torah. For example, Jeroboam. No, he tried to replace Torah with something else, an imitation of Torah. Here, it's just a custom. So there's nothing wrong with customs. It just really depends on the proportion and how you take it. If you're treating it this way or that way, it's an issue of balance. That's all.
Excellent. Very good. 26. When David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah. So he's greasing the wheels, right, to his friends, saying, yeah, "Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of Jehovah." Now, there's a whole list there. Do you want to highlight anything there?
It's scattered all over the place. I mean, he has people in Bet-El, El Ramot Negev, Yatir. So Bet-El is actually, if this is the original Bet-El, then this is actually, it's not really in Judah anymore. It's really in Benjamin more than anything else. Or maybe it is in Judah, for example. You know, it goes to Ramot Negev, Aroer, Sifmot, Eshtamoa, these are Berachal, the cities of the Yerchmielin, the cities of the Keni. These are mostly places in Judea. I mean, what he's basically doing is, as he said, he's establishing himself by saying, okay, look, I have these gifts, I have power, I have influence.
Mm.
You know, he knows exactly what he's doing, which kind of raises questions about, you know, some stuff. I mean, on the one hand, he understands that he is going to be the king of Israel. End of story. There's no doubt about it.
Mm.
On the other hand, he's struggling that he doesn't want to do anything to Saul, though Saul is trying to kill him, and he's also anointed one of God.
Mm.
He understands that God is going to be, God has chosen him, but he's still using tactics, which raises the question, you know, he doesn't trust in God. The answer is he does. It's just an issue that you also have to be practical. I mean, this is a contrast to what a lot of religious people are like today, where people think, oh, if you're religious, just throw your brain out and don't do anything. Don't be practical. And by the way, we have this phenomenon in everywhere. I mean, with every religious group, it's not practical at all. They start saying, you know, what I just described, you know, oh, we just trust in God and do whatever. No, you know, if someone's pointing a gun at you, you have to pray to God and try to protect yourself at the same time. You know, man was created in this world, which is a physical world, which is a world of actions. He doesn't sit there and say, oh, God's going to provide. You know, we there's a big, big argument here in Israel for decades now about, you know, ultra-Orthodox people, instead of going out to work, they want to sit in yeshiva and study all day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they want the government to subsidize them, and they want people, large, rich communities outside of Israel, communities that actually do work, to subsidize them. And now there's a whole outcry here in Israel regarding this, and they're saying this is not fair. You know, when I was ultra-Orthodox, I was very against this whole idea of, I'm going to sit around in yeshiva, study all day. No, you want to study Torah, fine, work and study Torah. You know, you can't go around saying, I'm going to sit in yeshiva all day round and just study, 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 study. Where's the food going to come from? How are you going to pay your bills? It's not going to fall out of the heavens. You know, there's an entry in the Talmud that talks about There were people who were trying to practice this, in the 3rd, 4th, 5th century, and it didn't work out for them. The Talmud was strongly against this as well. You have to be practical. I mean, there's no point in sitting around saying, oh, it's going to be okay. You know, in the Gulf War, it was a miracle. I mean, again, the Chabad, the Lubavitchers here in Israel, none of them had a safe room. None of them had, gas masks and everything. And people were asking, why aren't you doing this? So the Rebbe says that it's going to be perfectly fine. Mm. So they trusted him. You know, I can admire that. But essentially, what would have happened if something did go wrong?
Yeah.
So it was. Yeah. I mean, again, there's a saying that says, "En sumchin al hanes." You don't trust in miracles. Don't expect a miracle to happen every 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
In the ancient world, in the biblical world, miracles didn't happen every 5 minutes, because if it would have happened every 5 minutes, it wouldn't be a miracle anymore.
So true.
It would be natural, you know. Because the word in Hebrew for miracle is nes. Okay, and the word nes, for those who know some Hebrew or know Hebrew, you know that the word nes also means a pole or a flag. Says something that sticks out, mm-hmm. something that's there and noticeable.
Mm.
Okay, so it's the same thing. You know, you can't go around expecting miracles to happen all the time. But I think the worst thing I heard the past couple of days was a Coptic nun in Egypt that said, you know, they're in pretty bad shape. I mean, I once met a Coptic man who came to visit Israel, and he told me that their situation is terrible in Egypt, and he gave me descriptions, and he told him that a relative of his was murdered in the middle of the street just because he's a Christian. And one of the things, you know, there's a really bad shape, but they're not really doing much to protect themselves. And there was this nun that said, you know, I trust in God and the angels.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, yeah, trust in God, forget about the angels, and carry a 9mm gun on yourself or something, because you really have to protect yourself.
That's right. Certainly, and I can understand it. But the other thing as well, Yoel, it says, when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoils to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies. And what that says to his friends is that I'm still, you don't know where I am, but I'm still out doing the job. And let it be known among you all that I'm taking spoil from the enemies and I'm sending it back to you guys.
He's now informing them that he's a double agent.
Yeah, he is, because otherwise, you know, in case word gets back saying, hey, you know, David's been fighting with Achish and he's gone to our enemies now and he's on their side. No.
Yeah, exactly. It works for him, you know, also not just from the Philistines, but also from the Israelite side. And also, this might have happened after Saul was killed. By the way, it's quite possible this happened after Saul was killed. So he's using the tactic saying, okay, now that Saul is gone, I have to start establishing myself. And he's making sure that they know that he was not in the battle. He was nowhere near the battle.
Mm-hmm. And so
he's not involved. But the tribe of Benjamin did not believe this. Later on, we have a story with what was his name? Shimei ben Gera, I think his name was.
Yeah.
Where he blames David for that death. So he says, "Tse ish hadamim," you know, exit, go away, the man of blood. You know, because. They understood that his family understood that it was his fault that Saul died, but it wasn't. You know, talk about misunderstanding someone or misinterpreting someone. I mean, I have that every once in a while. I just had someone claim that I was a covert advocate of Christianity. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, but that happens. You know, so the same thing happened here. Rumors go around. There's nothing you can do about it.
No, that's right. So he's sending back the postcard saying, look, this is my alibi and this is what I've been doing and here's the proof and I'm sending it back to you. And Shimi, that's right. I'm looking, son of Gera. Yeah, you're right. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 5 and on, and we'll get there eventually. And so in any case, it finishes by saying, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. So anywhere that they thought that they might be visiting for whatever reason, they strategically sent some of the booty to, as I said at the beginning, to grease the wheels a little. So he's a good chess player, David. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, he has great tactic. It's just he goes for a lot of nasty stuff. I mean, David's character, as I mentioned already in the past, he suffers a lot. I mean, he really goes through a lot with other characters, with his family. It's not simple. Have you ever heard this statement? It's good to be the king. Not always. Sometimes it's really rough to be the king. To be a leader, to be a person in a position of knowledge or power is never that simple. There's a lot riding on your shoulders. There's a lot that people expect from you. And this is why, you know, people have to take breaks every once in a while.
you know, because it's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure. I mean, I woke up this morning going like, I don't have the energy to do anything, you know, because I'm spending most of my day studying and preparing lessons and preparing recordings. I mean, I do several recordings sometimes in 1 week, so it's very, very tiring. Mm. And, you know, there's a lot riding on your shoulders because you want to be as accurate as you can. You don't just woke up and just say whatever. I mean, really want
to do your research.
You have to do a lot of research and a lot of work. So I just woke up this morning, like, I looked at the ceiling going, I know when I'm going to leave bed.
But you got to get on with it.
Yeah, but you have to get on with it, which, you know, but you know, now we're reaching the end of the Book of Samuel. So we're now going to say it. We're actually going to go on a break after we're done with chapter 31. So this is one recording before last. There's going to be a quick break. No break for Jonah. Jonah has a lot of work to do, but I am taking a quick break.
You're not taking a break. You're going to be recording with Jeff, as I said at the beginning of the program. Next week, we're going to be doing the final chapter of 1 Samuel. We'll get to that next week, and that will be the end. We will be taking a break, and because I've got some things to catch up on as well. But God willing, we will return to 2 Samuel, so stay tuned, dear listeners. Yoel Ben Shlomo, my friend, thank you for being back on the program. Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, kol tov.